Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our Christmas event. Delighted to see so many of you here. This is a rather unusual event in that we are not going to have a lecture or a debate. But what we have to do is between David Howell, Lord Howell, and myself to make a few comments, which hopefully then will generate discussion from all of you. There's so much going on in the world to talk about. I'll throw a few stones at the pond, and David will probably do the same, and then we hope that you will feel free to make your views known as well. I think that's a useful way to be able to be fairly turbulent here. But if I could just start by saying that this is our last event of this year. Our next event will take place on Tuesday the 17th of January, when we're going to be hosting a discussion on the House of Lords Select Committee on International Relations Inaugural Report, the UK and the UN priorities for the new Secretary General. The Committee Chairman, David Howell, will obviously be leading that off together with two distinguished committee members, Lord Hanley Chiswick, who's with us here today, and Lord Landfield. They'll also be on the panel. They'll send the invitations out early in January if you're keen to come, as usual, let Jacqueline know. In the meantime, I'd like to thank you for your support this year and to wish you all a very happy Christmas when it comes. Today, we decided, as I say, to try and have a less formal session. I'd like to use it, first of all, to launch our annual pamphlet of lectures, which I think this year is a particularly impressive document, and I hope that you will have time to read it all. There's some very good people who were able to contribute to it. I think one you might like to look at is by going over to Professor Margaret McMillan, who opened our session last year, and who made, I thought, a very remarkable contribution, well worth reading, because there's so much of what she said in it in relation to what happened in the past, which has relevance to what is happening today and will happen in the future. But all the other lectures, I think you've all got copies of it. I think, again, they're well worth revisiting. And I'm very grateful to all those who contributed to us last year and enabled this publication to take place. I'd like to really today look at some of the events of the past. And I can start by asking Lord Howell, David Howell, to say a few words to us, hopefully to generate a good, interesting, if not heated discussion afterwards.
Michael, thank you. You put me up, I think. You didn't put it that way, but you want me to say nice things about the Global Strategy Forum, for a start. And I find absolutely no difficulty in doing that, because I admire what you, Michael, have done enormously. And I think over the last 10 years or so, if one wants to get a sort of view of the overall pattern of very fast-changing international relations and the character of international relations, this is the place to come, rather than, and I choose my words very carefully, rather than possibly to the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. Now, that's a rather strange thing to say, because foreign policy is obviously created and directed from the Foreign Office with varying degrees of success. But there is a strange, not so much death of foreign policy, a strange absence of coherence in a very incoherent world. And there are a number of reasons for this. I think I'm coming to the conclusion, rather melancholy conclusion, that international relations are now so complex, and the interface between this island and the rest of the world, as we try and reposition ourselves in this cobweb of networks and new groupings that are forming and unforming at amazing speed, which of course you can do in the digital age, you don't have to have permanent allies here, permanent anything really, is something that can only be orchestrated at overall government level, which means under our system at Downing Street and Cabinet Office level. And that is where our networking has really got to go on. Obviously, one thing that interests me greatly, and some of you know that, is the potential of something like the Commonwealth Network, simply because common language, common attitudes, some historical origins, although they're very slight now, but a gigantic connectivity, mainly outside government, not through governments at all. Other governments, if you talk to them, there's quite a lot of coolness and outright dislike between Commonwealth governments. But when you get down below the surface, as it were, with an iceberg, below the surface, a fantastic network of links, starting with primary school children, going right up through universities, through every branch of science, medicine, architecture, consultancy, police training, and the list goes on and on and on, nursing, everything you can see, all growing at a fantastic pace. And for a country like ours, which is 81% service industry, and with 51% of our export earnings coming from services and growing, I'm not saying goodbye to the containers and the great shipping, but certainly a vast importance of digital information exports. That is a very important network indeed. Anyway, that is just my first observation, but I think the GSF has done wonders in giving an overview and bringing all these things together in a way that individual Whitehall departments find it quite difficult to do, despite all the coordinated mechanisms. What's behind all this? My state of life, I find one tends to have a sort of current portfolio of grumbles. Now, my grumble for the week I will share with you, which is je jeune and rather inexperienced columnists and commentators, and indeed some members of parliament, and dare I say it, some ministers, all rediscovering things about the way the world works which have been plainly obvious for 20 years. And anyone who's thought deeply about them can see, and many books have been written about, and yet they're suddenly emerging. The discovery of this week is apparently that the digital age empowers populism, empowers an anti-elite mass feeling, and really this has been blindingly obvious for the last 20 to 25 years. It's clear, even before the invention of the so-called social media, the internet was enough with the rising of the World Wide Web to see that people were going to take on and challenge governments and question them and question everything governments tried to do and their legitimacy and authority on a scale which had never been seen before in history. This was obvious from 20 years ago. It's grown and grown. When the infection or disease hit the Middle East, we saw the results. Tyrants overthrown, but no democracy emerging instead. Just a jumble of grievances and views and tribal settlements and conflicts, which have created the worst horrors we've seen, really, almost since the Second World War. So, nothing very new about that. And then along comes the further manifestations of it in our own Atlantic area, the Brexit movement, the rejection by a majority, well, the last one, but by a majority of the alleged authority and superiority and remoteness of the EU institutions. Along comes Mr. Trump, America allegedly rejecting some elite, which is dreamt up, of course, is wonderful material for demagogues, all empowered by the microchip. It was there, it's been there all along. There is nothing new whatsoever in the unfolding of events of which the Brexit and Trump are merely phenomenon. And we could say passing phenomenon, but that phenomenon in one step forward. So it's a view of vast incoherence, and the only way to look at it is in the way that you, Michael, and the Global Strategy Forum are looking at it. And the only way to deal with it, I think, is by a Whitehall, which obviously was born in a different era before the invention of the computer, certainly before the invention of today's interconnectivity on a massive, continuous, minute-by-minute scale never known before in the world, has got to rethink and is trying to rethink, I believe, struggling to rethink its way of ordering its affairs and linking up the interface of what used to be called foreign policy, international policy, with its home affairs, which are all, as the Americans are fond of saying, one ball of wax. So that's really my opening comment to you, which is full of opportunities for challenges and own goals and so on. But I do believe we are dealing with a new and different world. Manuel Castell said that 25 years ago in his brilliant books, The Rise of the Democracy in the Rise of the Internet Age. He described in three brilliant volumes, still the greatest work ever written, forecasting everything that has happened. Political parties would be under strain, big trade unions would be under strain, large blocs like the European Union would be under strain, arguments about economies of scale and centralism would all be under strain, and the way we talk, our language, our education, the way we get born, married and die would all be changed by the internet revolution. That's what he forecast. He was right. It was obvious. And it's just dawning on one or two of our policymakers now. But in the meantime, we've got the GSF to guide us through the labyrinth, So, on with the show. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. I apologize, I didn't make my remarks sitting down, but I'm not very good at standing for long periods at the moment. But thank you for your kind remarks about GSF. I would like to add to those, first of all, by saying without our advisory board, we would not be able to proceed as we do with the type of speakers we get. And I'm delighted that two of our advisory board are here today, Sir Leland Rothschild and Sir David Manning. I'm very grateful to them for all the help they've given us during the year. I'm sure you would also like to show your appreciation to them. And secondly, in paying tribute, I would be very amiss if I wasn't to mention Jacqueline. Because basically, I take the credit, she does the work. That's right, the right way round. Please notice. I think, David, you raised some very interesting points. I found this year fascinating. There's some various concepts which I'm still struggling with. The concept of the post-truth world, which I keep reading about. And the more I read about it, the more it does appear to be true. One example of this was this week. I mean, I've known Boris Johnson probably most of his life. And I've always regarded things he's written with a certain amount of scepticism, sometimes with total disbelief, but always rather enjoying the humour behind them. And then this week, suddenly, to my amazement, he said something which I thought was completely true. He said the Iran and Saudi Arabia were waging surrogate wars, which I thought we all knew. What else was amazing was he was landed on by a ton of bricks from Downing Street downwards, and he didn't know what he was talking about. So maybe that is evidence of the post-truth society. I want to look, just to add to what David's done, it's what I think are some of the lessons that we missed, some of the lessons that still need to be learned. I'm not going to talk a lot about Brexit, that was one of the main events of the year. But one of the things that amazed me about it was that I'd always been brought up to believe, and certainly when I was in government, that contingency planning was a very important part of our process. Even if we didn't like what might happen, we always planned just in case it happened. And I was amazed after the 23rd of June to learn that there'd been instructions that the civil service weren't even able to look at this. And when nobody said there's no plan, there wasn't any plan, because nobody had asked for a contingency plan to be written. And I do think there is a lesson to be learned, whatever your views on Brexit, that it's very unwise to get oneself in a situation where one's left in a complete void and vacuum as a result of a particular decision which is taken on the back of whatever you want to call it, a popular vote or populism or whatever. But I think there's certainly a lesson to be learned there. The second Brexit lesson is this. I'm not involved at all in the post-Brexit procedures, but we seem to be working out how we make new relations with Europe as it is. Now, I'm old enough to believe that things change really fast, and I don't believe the Europe we'll be dealing with in 2 years' time is necessarily the Europe we see today. I think we should be thinking very carefully about how we're going to deal with possibly a rather different Europe, or even a very different Europe. And again, contingency planning, so that when it happens, we are not going to find ourselves completely isolated and adrift. There are other lessons too. I'm going to be rather patchy today. I just want to throw out ideas to get some discussion from them. I've been arguing for a long time that we should never enter a foreign adventure without a clear and legal purpose, an identifiable national interest, a clear idea of what we intend to do and achieve, and a credible exit strategy. Now, if you look at Iraq and then you look at Libya, my view is those elements were not there. And you would have thought we'd learned that. In a sense, we're lucky because we didn't get too involved in Syria. It hasn't hurt us too much that we didn't have them there either. But it does really suggest that if, as David was saying, the Foreign Office is to produce a foreign policy, we need to feel that there's a purpose and a strategy behind it. And you've heard me say this before. One of my irritations when we were in Afghanistan, I was shadow foreign secretary, I would say, when are we going to get out? And the answer always was, when the job's done. And I would say, how will we know when the job's done? And they say, when we get out. And that seemed to be a very clear epitome of why we, in the end, didn't really know what we were doing. I think it's also important we try to stop rewriting history. Iraq was a lesson. Libya was a lesson. But we now seem to have written them off. And as I say, Syria. Syria fascinates me. Who told our government that Assad was going to fall within days when the problem arose. I used to go a lot to Syria. I knew what was happening in Damascus. I knew that most of the people who supported Assad were actually Sunni. They were secular Sunni, well paid, well pensioned. They weren't interested in religious wars. They weren't going to see their boss overthrown that easily. But for about 3 months, we kept on saying he's about to fall. I was told at one moment we got a senior military figure to defect, and this was the beginning of the end of Assad and his regime. 5 years later, 6 years later, he's still there. What I'm asking is, who's providing that information? Was this the sort of information we went to war in Iraq on? And if it was, why didn't we learn the lessons of Iraq so we didn't make that sort of mistake again in the future? So that is something which I do hope that over the months ahead we will be able to pursue. And what was the information that allowed Alex Younger last week, in what was a rather remarkable speech, to announce that Russia's intervention in Syria was the cause of the IS threat to this country? And he may know things I don't, and he certainly does. But we had the IS threat to this country before Russia got involved in Syria. So again, where is this information coming from? What is it based on? How much of it is propaganda? This is what I asked earlier. The world of post-truth can easily become the world where propaganda becomes more important than truth. And I think we do need quietly to challenge these things before they go too far. I'm watching the terrible events in Aleppo at the moment, a wonderful city, which I love. I don't know quite a lot of the time who to believe. Certainly, I mean, I went to Damascus very recently, expecting to find destruction and horror, and found a city that was running perfectly normally. So I get a bit sceptical about some of the things I hear and read. But as far as Aleppo is concerned, I read yesterday that the Secretary of State, John Kerry, had called for the rebels in the remains of Aleppo to be allowed to depart with dignity. Okay. But I wonder to myself, with all the other things I've heard, how many of those rebels would be allowed under the terrorist acts to come to this country? That's quite a good test as to whether they should just be allowed to disappear or not. So those are the sort of questions which I think we continue to need to ask and to challenge. It is time to get real. We've got to balance the moral high ground, which I'm a great believer in being on, with the political and geopolitical realities. And when the moral high ground, as it has in many areas, slowly slides into being less than moral, I think we've got to know how we react to that. At the moment, I'm not sure we do. And I think, again, on civil rights, I'm all for being pragmatic, but at some moment we have to have some consistency. I know why we trade in Saudi Arabia, why we're polite to them. I've been part of that. But to treat them as if they were different in terms of civil rights to some of the other regimes in the area seems to me to be a double standard. I'm not sure at the end of the day we do ourselves any favours by doing that. And looking to the future, one of our problems in the past has been, perhaps understandably with restricted resources, we haven't always had the resource availability to get the right intelligence at the right time in the right place. And I'm looking now at North Africa. I think Algeria, over the next 12 months to 18 months, is going to become a very serious concern. And I wonder how much intelligence people are coming from that country and how reliable it is. And that's also going to spill over into Tunisia. I know Tunisia very well. And the level of our intelligence there is remarkably light. It's part of the French area, but some moment if we're going to get involved in these things, we've got to know that we know enough about them. Briefly, just touching on Trump, I'm amazed at how Trump has got where he's got to. I'm alarmed at what's going to happen in the future. But again, I think we have got to work out how we use this ourselves to our best advantage. Is he going to be capable of creating a stronger relationship with the United Kingdom than there's been for some time? Is he going to open up opportunities to allow better relations, say, with other countries where we've had rather dubious ones in the past? I don't know either. But I think we've got to be open-minded because he's there. And in a way, if we can try and see how we can get a best advantage, that seems to be the way forward. And finally this, I mean, we are now no longer, and I think David really alluded to this, we're no longer in the superpower's great game. We're at best a strong supporting cast, and even at worst sometimes just spear cowards on the stage. And we need to adjust our game accordingly. I've argued for strengthening our defence forces, but really always on the basis of what we need here for our own defence. I think in terms of what we do overseas, our strengths are things like our special forces, our intelligence, our soft power abilities. And I think we've got to look much more carefully at how we use those much more cleverly. And that's where we'll get our influence in the future. So that's really all I want to say today. I think we've generated some thoughts. I'll get some reactions. Thank you very much.